Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carrillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah, and you're listening to the Tennis Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, live from Putney Richmond and Solihull respectively. A special hello to everybody that is joining us live on YouTube. There has already been one Gilmore Girls reference in the chat, and everybody has been telling us the various locations around the world that they're joining us from, and it's been a true joy to witness. So enjoy that if you are here live. If you're not, that's fine. It's rubbish. You're not missing anything. David joins us from Solihull. David, how are you doing?
I'm very well, very well. And I'm delighted to say that the sun shone today, which is the first for 2024. So it just felt that little bit Indian Wellsy for this year, given we weren't there.
Yes, today is the one-year anniversary of my renting a red Mustang for 10 minutes before being told to return it by David because our luggage wouldn't fit. my 10 minutes of glamour, Matt, we all remember it fondly.
I will never forget the look on David's face where he at least let us try and get the luggage in for 10 minutes. But he knew all along that it was just never going to fit, and we returned our red convertible Mustang for a sensible Cameron Norrie car.
Yes. Yeah, we went from Carlos Alcaraz to Cameron Norrie to Indian Wells champions, hey. Of course. We have our champions in Indian Wells. They are Carlos Alcaraz and Iga Świątek. We're going to be talking about all the tennis that happened in Indian Wells since we were last with you, which, to be fair, was only Friday morning. But I do feel like a fair bit has happened since then. Before we get into all of that, a moment, please, for our sponsors on location, the premium hospitality and experience provider.
We got that
They're sponsoring our coverage of the Sunshine Double in Indian Wells and Miami, and on location can arrange the best tennis experiences imaginable to all of the biggest tournaments in the world, including the US Open. Their travel packages include a choice of stay at the five-star Mandarin Oriental. Fun fact, Stefan Edberg, whenever he played the Legends event at the Royal Albert Hall at the end of the year that David and I used to work on, would insist upon only staying at the Mandarin Oriental Hotel.
And that's also where I interviewed Leighton Hewitt when he was world number one, but in Miami. At the Mandarin Oriental.
I think it's safe to say it's a favourite among the tennis fraternity. Yeah. Or there is also to stay at the four-star Park Lane or Intercontinental hotels, which I'm sure are also great favourites among the tennis fraternity. You get a choice of seats in the Promenade, Loge or Stadium Suite in Arthur Ashe Stadium, or courtside in Louis Armstrong Stadium, or a combination of both. You get daily round-trip transportation from the hotels. You get a gift pack. You get an on-site tour host, and you get optional access to the Overlook Hospitality area. What is the Overlook Hospitality experience? It's all-inclusive dining from a chef-curated buffet. It's all-inclusive soft drinks, beer and wine from not one, folks, but multiple bars. It's an air-conditioned indoor lounge. You had me at air-conditioned. I'm sold. I'll pay whatever you're asking where air-conditioning and the US Open is concerned. You get an outdoor rooftop bar and lounge. Also, if you didn't have me at air-conditioning, you had me at rooftop bar. You get multiple indoor and outdoor flat-screen TVs to watch the action while you enjoy your drinks and nibbles. You get priority gate access and early access to the grounds and lots more. So that is what On Location are offering. Just go to tours4tennis/tennispodcast. Tours, the number 4, tennis/. Is it podcast or tennis podcast, David? Either way, the link will be in our show notes.
It's tours4tennis.com/podcast. I forgot to write that down, didn't I?
That's the one. Yeah, tried to freestyle. Always check the small print, folks. The link is in our show notes, though. Onwards to Indian Wells, or maybe backwards to Indian Wells, because it's all over, folks, for another year. Our champions, Iga Świątek and Carlos Alcaraz. Let's start with Świątek, her second title there in 3 years, beating Maria Sakkari 6-4, 6-love in the final. It's her eighth WTA title at 1,000 level. And we had a bit of a debate about this match on our WhatsApp group after it yesterday, and our levels of disappointment in it varied a little, didn't it? I had managed to convince myself that this might be more of a match than it turned out to be. I was quite won over by Maria Sakkari's performance in that semi-final. And look, I was very much still expecting Świątek to win, but 4-love wasn't what I was expecting. I was pretty disappointed in the match, quite frankly, but I was shot down by Matt and David telling me it was ever going to be thus. Because Świątek's just so damn good.
Yeah, I mean, look, let's just slightly correct that, because it was Matt who was the downer on it all. I was with you, Catherine. I was up on it. Now, that may not be a massive surprise to most people, but there was a number of reasons for my enthusiasm for the match ahead of time. One is the fact that their head-to-head reveals several wins for Maria Sakkari. Okay, they're a while ago, but she has beaten her. Secondly, David Witt in her corner, I felt there was a difference to the way she was carrying herself, playing. I thought her win over Coco Gauff was really impressive, and she should have done it in straight sets. And they kind of both did what they tend to do. Gauff digging in, fighting back, Sakkari tightening. But she still then romped away with the third set. And look, in that opening set, whilst it was 6-4, 6-love, you know, she went 3-love down and got back to 3-all and then 4-all, and you're right in a match there. And it would have been so interesting to find out what would have happened had she not lost a serve at that point and immediately lost the set. You know, it's one of those, you go 4-5 down, you lose your serve, you're done. And then look, it's very easy to not give Iga Świątek the credit that she deserves, because she's the most incredible final player. She's an incredible player anyway, and it still shocks me that she doesn't actually do better at, like, win all the Grand Slams, or at least reach the final of all the Grand Slams. But that second set was as high level as you can get, I think. I mean, Sakkari, maybe there's one or two things in hindsight she'd do differently, but she said it herself, I don't know what to do, because how can you know what to do against that?
You mentioned the head-to-head, and that Sakkari at one point in their respective careers had a winning head-to-head against Świątek. I think it was even going into yesterday's match, but now... Or maybe Sakkari did have the edge. But anyway, Sakkari losing yesterday removes one more name from the list of players with a winning head-to-head, a list of active players with a winning head-to-head against Iga Świątek. It's now down to just Elena Rybakina, who only edges the head-to-head by one win, I think 3-2. And Elena Ostapenko, who just totally stands alone with that 4-0 head-to-head against Iga Świątek. It's absolutely wild. But yeah, I guess, look, I know those wins that Sakkari got against Świątek was before Świątek proverbially came Świątek. It was before the streak, wasn't it? Weren't they? But I don't know. There's obviously something in that matchup that Sakkari enjoys. Matt, tell us why you were down on it and proven right.
I absolutely take all the points about how good this tournament was for Sakkari, and I really do think she made some strides. And honestly, not only now working with David Witt, but let's also remember, go back to the start of the year, she told us she was working with Ben Crowe, the sort of mindset coach who helped Ash Barty. Like, there's been a big change in Team Sakkari this year, and she's also using a new racket, and that can sometimes take a little bit of time to get used to that. So I do think Sakkari is hopefully trending in a really good direction, but sort of all of that just felt a little bit irrelevant to me, because it was Sakkari still in a final, and we know that she's got big problems when she gets to a final, against Iga Świątek in a final, who is just incredible in finals. And in those conditions in Indian Wells, she loves them so much. Look, I still, I guess, was a little bit surprised it was that one-sided. I think, as David said, 4-4 in the first set, pretty close. But then Świątek won 32 of the next 40 points. Like, it was an absolute hammering from that point onwards. Sakkari only won 1 point on her serve in the second set, and only 5 points in that second set in total. So I guess I was surprised by that one-sided nature of it in that second set. And I, you know, it does just go to show, I think, that Sakkari, there's still so much potential and work for her to do to get to anywhere close to closing the gap to Iga Świątek. But Świątek is just so good in finals, such a good front runner. She's never lost a match at WTA 1000 level when she's won the first set. She totally freed up after that first set and was absolutely awesome. And yeah, like, we've seen her be that good in finals before and lay down six love sets on people. So I guess I couldn't be that surprised by what I saw.
Have we seen enough from Maria Sakkari this fortnight in Indian Wells? She was great. It was, of course, a fantastic tournament for her reaching the final. And as I say, I was really won over by that victory over Coco Gauff in the semi-finals. I was so impressed by her. It was one of those matches that I just felt like, even though Sakkari's playing the better tennis, I just thought, somehow Gauff's just going to find a way to win this, because she does. This is, you know, she's just sort of being set up to win ugly. And to overcome the force of competitiveness that is Coco Gauff, I thought was brilliant from Sakkari. But she has reached finals in Indian Wells before. She's played great tennis at Indian Wells before. Do we have enough data to be able to say that this is potentially a new Maria Sakkari, or is the jury still out?
I honestly think it's both. I feel very encouraged by this, because she's had a tough time. She's been in a trough, really, for a while. And, you know, there would have been an argument to have suggested that this might not have happened at all, that even the Indian Wells run on her favoured surface in her favoured conditions wasn't going to happen again because of scar tissue and because of losing away and everybody else getting better. And actually, she's back there. She's got there on merit. I think in order to feel like this is different, or that it might potentially be different, she'd have to do it again. She'd have to do it somewhere else. She needs to build on it. And I just feel like she's capable. This is a woman who should be great on the clay season if she can get going, because of her physicality and her kind of ball trajectory on the forehand in particular. You know, that is a dominant looking forehand. The backhand is flat and it's sort of bunted, isn't it? But it's still a good shot a lot of the time. And I just feel I continue to be really interested in what David Witt, her coach, helps her to achieve sort of mentally. You know, success isn't all about coaches, but I do think he is such a difference to her, you know, as a personality, that I'm very interested to see where that leads to. And I'd be disappointed for her if she would have really tailspin now, because this is a great platform. She's got all the ability. She's got the physicality. And I just feel like that there's another step coming. But I'd have to see something else other than the Indian Wells final, personally, to believe that this is going to be a regular occurrence.
Yeah, and I think even like the semi-final, you could read in two ways. You could say, oh, it was those, you know, it was that old habit of being in the lead and then losing the lead and suddenly finding herself in a third set that she probably shouldn't have been in, even though Goff did raise her game tremendously in that second half of the second set. But then you could also say the line that Mary Carrillo so often says, well, she choked, but she won anyway. And I think there was some growth there, I suppose, in particular in her demeanour after that, because I thought she stayed really calm. She didn't get too flustered after she lost that second set. And I think went down a break right at the start of the third as well. I think previous Sakkari doesn't win that match in that circumstance, even in Indian Wells, which she likes. So I think there's still traces, there's still bits in her system, aren't there, of the Sakkari that we've seen for so long now, for 2 years. It's going to take more than one tournament just for that to go. But there were good signs. But I agree with David, like, we need to see more. It's impossible to say that Sakkari is fully changed, because, you know, it was Indian Wells, which she does like. So it makes her one of the most interesting players to watch, I think, going into this, Miami and then the clay court season.
Yeah, I'd love it if she were a player transformed. I really would. I agree with everything David you said about her game. I worry that the mental side of it isn't there, and that too much baggage is accumulated. I think she might have left it a year or two too late to pull the trigger on the change. But I hope to be wrong. I really, really hope to be wrong about that. And I will be watching her very, very closely in the weeks and months to come. Just won't spend too long on this, because it was something we covered in Friday's show, but on the Sakkari Goff semi-final, Coco Gauff's serve was a mess. Again, now I understand, and a few people are pointing out in the chat here as well, that Coco Gauff was a little bit under the weather in that match. I think she was feeling a bit nauseous, but the fact is that the serving problems were not isolated to that match. She's, on the basis of the last couple of weeks, got quite a big issue on serve. And as we were saying on Friday, it is in her head. How worried about this are we for Coco Gauff?
I must say I was surprised on that shot. I tend to think of it more. I thought she'd sorted that one out more, really, and that the forehand was the bigger issue. And that there was it was really jarring the other day against Yuan Yue, the way she just, like, the rest of her game was carrying her to the victory, but her serve was just a liability. Double fault after double fault. Just she couldn't keep it in, couldn't keep the frustration in on her face. And then in the semi-final, I thought she'd corrected it, because she was absolutely blasting down first serve aces at one stage, several of them. And it just looked like, okay, I mean, you know, that match was going with serve. It was really close, and it was cool, actually, the way she was just, they were just going toe-to-toe like that. And then suddenly it collapsed again. And she doesn't seem to know why in the moment, or at least she seems powerless to do anything about it. I would still back her to find some sort of solution, because I think basically from what Pam says and other people that know more about serves than me, it's actually, you know, it's got a lot for going for it. And it was kind of regarded as a strength when she came out on the tour. But I'm still a little bit confused by how to view Coco Gauff's performances. I mean, I think I have nothing but the utmost respect for the fact she managed to win the US Open, not even playing her best tennis. But when is she going to play her best tennis? I can't really remember watching her and thinking, now that's her best tennis. That is awesome. Vintage Coco Gauff. To me, vintage Coco Gauff is finding a way and digging in and showing. And actually, the other thing she does brilliantly is when she's absolutely back against the wall, she comes out swinging. And I kind of think is maybe the answer to just come out swinging from the off.
Matt?
Be fun to see that. I guess it's just that...
Is it possible? I don't know.
I guess she's still having good results, isn't she, with her, you know, with...
She's very
with
consistent.
With her current approach. Like, it would feel a bit drastic to change too much, I suppose, at the moment. Yeah, like, the serve was really... She was cranking it up, wasn't she, to high 120 miles per hour in Australia, and she didn't have the double fault problems, but they've sort of crept in again in the last few weeks. Yeah, as I said on Friday's pod, like, it's a bit all over the place at the moment for Goff. Like, you don't quite know what you're going to get. But again, she's coming into a time of the season that she really likes with Miami, with, you know, the sort of, she so used to those conditions, and then the clay as well. Like, I think there's a chance here for Goff to have a great few months, you know, and hopefully sort of more sort of confidence brings out the best in her game.
Do we have anything else to say about Świątek before we move on to the men's via the women's doubles? I mean, she's just bloody good, isn't she?
She's so good. And actually, I was listening back to the conversation we had after Świątek lost at the Australian Open this year when she lost to Noskova. And we were having a real debate, sort of, how do we view Iga Świątek? Because she is so far ahead of everyone else on the tour. Like, she's winning hard court tournaments regularly to go with clay court tournament. She's laying down 6-love and 6-1 sets, but it's just not translating quite as much to sort of hard court slam dominance. And I don't know, it just feels like that's going to continue to be the conversation, because we know how good she is week in, week out. She is the best player in the world by far. It just feels like sort of she's sort of peaking all the time, and it just feels like at the slams maybe other players are sort of peaking at those, and she's a little bit more vulnerable at them. But she's so young, she's winning all the time, like she's great.
I know this isn't always relevant to winning tennis matches. It's so often about the floor rather than the ceiling, etc., etc. But is Iga Świątek's peak the highest on the WTA?
On clay, yes.
I don't
only
know.
Only on clay?
I think the loss to Rybakina at Indian Wells last year always sticks in my mind, because that was Indian Wells, slow hard courts, her favourite conditions, and we just saw what Elena Rybakina did to her. I think it pretty much is. I think other players maybe have a little bit more potential to take the racket out of her hands in that matchup. You know, she is a little bit vulnerable still to players, but then they're not as comfortable against other players, you know, and Iga Świątek is. I do think Świątek's peak pretty much is the best.
Are you saying, therefore, curious for both of your views, that her peak isn't possible against another player hitting huge ground strokes at a Grand Slam when they're at their peak?
Well, the data shows that to be the case.
Is she not able to exert her authority, I wonder? Or did she just not play very well on those days, do you think?
I think when Sabalenka plays out of her mind, it's matches. The match is on her racket, no matter who's down the other end of the court, just because of the power that she has.
Because, I mean, there's quite a lot of losses. If you go through them in the last couple of years, and look, I don't want to give Iga Świątek a hard time, right? Because she is amazing, and overall she's the best. She's world number one. She's won all these tournaments. She's won several French Open. She's won a US Open. But she's also lost to Elise Cornet and Elena Rybakina and Linda Noskova. Who did she lose to? Was it Vondrousova she lost to at Wimbledon last year? I can't remember now. But, you know, she's lost a lot of huge matches where I'm expecting her to... Like, I keep picking her to win all these tournaments. Am I the one who's made an error? Like, I mean, obviously I am. But, like...
Svitolina,
you know,
wasn't it?
Yeah.
I mean,
yes.
I think the slower the surface, the more the answer is yes to is her peak. It becomes less and less yes with, you know, if there was a graph.
Yeah. And I guess the US Open, I guess the US Open and the Australian Open are faster conditions than quite a lot of the tour hardcore events, you know. But I don't know, it sort of feels bad to be having this conversation about Świątek now after she's just won Indian Wells, I suppose. Like, she's done all that she can right now. It's just interesting because I feel like we've had this conversation before about Iga Świątek. Oh, she's so clearly the best player in the world. She's going to get to the next slam and win it. But I think until she wins another hard court slam, I think that's going to sort of remain a big question.
Okay, well, back to the positives. Should we talk about Zendaya and Tom Holland mimicking the Iga Świątek fist pump? David, do you know who Zendaya and Tom Holland are?
Yeah, I saw them on the telly last night. They're on the screen, and the commentator said who they were. And then you told me who they were.
Apparently, she's got a tennis film coming out.
Yeah,
which
that's
might
a bit on you.
Explain why she was wearing a tennis outfit to watch the tennis.
I knew she was. I knew she was in a tennis film.
There's a certain category of tennis journalist that like wears tennis kit.
Yeah,
we all know them.
I mean, really, if she wanted to do promo for her film, she probably should have been at the Phoenix Challenger because the film is all about playing a challenger tournament.
Yes, it's called. Isn't it called Challengers?
Yes.
Challenger. Oh. Challengers. They are not sponsoring this podcast. I don't know. Don't know why we're going so deep in the promo.
Who's Tom Holland and is he in it as well?
Tom Holland is our neighbour. Mm. He lives down the road, doesn't he, in Kingston? He's Spider-Man, David.
Oh. Which version? I mean, there's loads of that.
David, do yourself a favour and watch Tom Holland lip-sync battle. In fact, maybe just leave the podcast and go and watch Tom Holland's lip-sync battle now.
Yeah, it's a rule that whenever that comes on the timeline, you have to watch it.
Yeah, I'd quite like to watch David's reaction to Tom Holland's lip-sync battle. Anyway, we digress. Shall we talk about, before we move on to the men's, let's give a mention to Shea Sue and Elisa Mertens, who won the doubles title. They beat Storm Hunter Katerina Siniakova 6-3, 6-4 in the final. And Shea Sue, in so doing, has become the world number one, which is brilliant, and that's a great story. She's, what, 41? Years of age, but when I read the story, I did think, God, doubles rankings are stupid. She has leapfrogged her partner to become the world number one after they both won a title. Like, it's just stupid. Anyway, sorry to be a downer about all these titleists. They're obviously brilliant. I actually watched a bit of this final, and she is just absurdly good. She is absurdly good. You know, the opposition, they're actively trying to keep the ball away from her. And yet it seems like impossible to keep the ball away from her. She's always just there. She's
like a Jedi. Like,
yeah, she is a bit.
Yeah. And she said afterwards, didn't she, that she'd been ill in the lead up to the tournament. So she'd barely played, but just sort of picked up her rackets and sort of casually won the doubles.
That's so Shay, isn't it? Yeah. Anyway, congratulations to them and congratulations to Shay for becoming the world number one. Ignore what I've got to say about it.
Hi, this is Craig Robinson from Ways to Win. And support for this podcast comes from Invesco QQQ, the official ETF of the NCAA. Invesco QQQ is proud to sponsor this episode and even prouder to provide access to innovation for the last 25 years. Basketball has had innovations over the years, too. We're seeing the game played in new ways every day. Learn more at Invesco.com/QQQ. Let's rethink possibility. Invesco Distributors, Inc.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
We move on to the men's event, won by Carlos Alcaraz, rubbing it in Daniil Medvedev's nose by defending the title, something that Daniil Medvedev is so far in his career categorically unable to do. 7-6, 6-1 in the final. It's Alcaraz's first title since Wimbledon, something that has been much documented. I actually wanted to start this portion of the show by talking about the semi-final, the Sinner-Raz semi-final that we had to wait many, 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 many hours for. So many hours due to rain that many people, certainly in the UK, would have had to go to bed. Not me and Matt or Billie Jean, although she tried.
Gave us time to watch the Fulham highlights multiple times.
Multiple. I've seen those three goals several times. We've watched several different ways of packaging those three goals on
every
YouTube.
Angle,
thanks very much.
Every celebration.
Pretty much, yeah. Look, we had about 4 hours to fill, didn't we? Anyway, people like David that go to bed at sensible times wouldn't have been able to watch that match live. And lots of those people would have caught up with it via highlights packages, much like Matt and I did with Fulham Spurs, even though Matt was actually at the game. I am getting to a point here. The highlights package definitely would have made that match look like an epic because the highs were incredibly high. The highs were everything you'd expect from Sinner Alcaraz. And yet, people that were there live watching it point by point, having waited hours for it, the truthers, if you will, we know better, don't we? That was not an epic match. It was enjoyable. There were some great highs. I'm glad I watched it. It was not a classic. Back me up here, Matt.
Yeah, I think that's true. The first set, Sinner was absolutely awesome, but after that rain delay, Alcaraz just played such a terrible service game and never really recovered for the rest of the set. Just the sheer pace on Sinner's shots seemed to mean that he couldn't sort of control the ball. He made a brilliant adjustment tactically in the second set and started looping a lot more and slow balling and just generally trying to throw Sinner off his rhythm. And that was the set really where there were the most spectacular points. And then the third set, Sinner was feeling his leg. He dived for a shot at one point and seemed to hurt his wrist. And sort of all throughout the set, his forehand was sort of just way, way off. So, look, I don't think it was an absolute thriller all the way through, but it is interesting. And I think it's absolutely right that will look amazing in highlights. And in a way, that's almost just as important because I do think that is how a lot of people will consume their tennis. It will generate an awful lot of buzz. There were so many points that you could pick out that went sort of viral on social media and people were talking about this match. I had a lot of messages from just casual tennis fans in my life who were talking about, did you see Sinner Alcaraz? Wasn't it amazing? Because they'd just seen a few of these points. And I think that is the power of this rivalry, because they are so exciting when they come up against each other in certain rallies. And I think it's also very much the point in their careers that they're at. They're just so explosive and electric. I think as they get older and mature, their games will probably become much more well-rounded, and their matches will be sort of more complete and maybe a bit more grueling. Certainly that's what happened in the Nadal-Djokovic rivalry, wasn't it? They were just electric to begin with, and then they just played these epics all the time with sort of grinding tennis. I think Alcaraz and Sinner have got these fast arms. They're always going to be hitting spectacular shots, absolutely. But I think they will round out and maybe be more consistent matches as we go forward. But like right now, the peaks are so high that those are enough to sort of sustain you and create so much buzz. And yeah, it wasn't a thriller, but it was still very enjoyable all the same. And I'm pleased it happened.
Such a good point about the importance of a match transferring well into highlights for the success of tennis and for its prominence with particularly the younger generation. There was great tennis in there. They just didn't quite play well at the same time. Now, obviously, we don't know the extent to which injury was a factor for Jannik Sinner. It was sort of slightly a confused situation physically for Sinner, because midway through the second set, after I think Alcaraz had started to turn the tide, I don't think it was simply Sinner faded physically and Alcaraz took over. Alcaraz had already made the tactical adjustment at this point, which really turned the tide on the match. But Sinner started stretching out his calf. Looked like the sort of thing you do when you're cramping, but I've never really seen Sinner cramp before. It wasn't hot or humid. I'd be surprised if it was that. And then, so he was definitely losing speed on the serve, I guess, as a result of that. And then there was also a point where he fell and landed very awkwardly on his wrist. Didn't have any physio treatment for either issue, but definitely, to a greater or lesser extent, wasn't right physically for the tail end of that match, I would say. But I don't know, David, how big a determining factor was Sinner's waning physicality in the outcome of that match for you?
I definitely think it was a factor, and. I'm going to save my judgment on it a little bit to see how he pulls up in Miami, to see whether he looks like he's been affected at all. And I'm curious to know really whether that was a big problem for him, whether he really was feeling it. I mean, he had that fall, and he definitely looked shaken up by that. And I'm not surprised. I think most people would be. But I also was a little bit surprised the way he sort of started to decline in the match, because he was so good in that first set, you know, especially after the break. Obviously they've had the rain, he's come back out, he's just stamped his authority on that match. And I just thought we were going to see the Jannik Sinner that has just run over this draw to that point, and frankly run over everybody all year apart from Dano Medvedev for a couple of sets in that final, and that didn't happen. Now, a lot of credit for that has to be given to Alcaraz, and I actually think this was the most tactically astute Alcaraz that I've ever seen. The way he just adjusted and moved and started returning serve in Dano Medvedev's position at the back of the sort of backstop, you know, next to the ball kits, just wasn't expecting that at all. And I think that was really encouraging from an Alcaraz perspective. You know, that was the opposite of everything he showed in Australia, when I was concerned about, frankly, I questioned his professionalism, the way he had approached the match with Zverev. He just looked like he was panicking and like he had no game plan. Well, he was totally different here. But I was still surprised that Sinner just kind of drifted away in the match, and it sort of just happened to him. And Darren Cahill was saying things to him like, try to be unpredictable. And I just, I don't think of Jannik Sinner as needing to be unpredictable as such. I see him as being able to just sweep opponents off the court. Maybe I'm just oversimplifying all that as somebody who doesn't coach and doesn't play. But I thought he would do more. I thought he would sustain it better than that. And maybe that's just injury related.
I do think that tactical adjustment that Alcaraz made in that semi-final was quite a big moment, actually, quite a big shift for Alcaraz. I remember the chat we had after his loss to Zverev at the Australian Open, and I remember describing how I just don't think of him as a tactical player at all. He's the ultimate in, I'm just going to go out there and do my Carlos Alcaraz thing. I do not think of him as going out there sort of armed with thoughts about, I'm going to play to his forehand or to, I mean, definitely against Zverev, he wasn't doing that, was he? Because he barely played to the guy's forehand, which is, everybody knows, is the weaker wing. But there were very clear tactics on display in a lot of matches that he was playing in Indian Wells, but it was most clear against Sinner, and I think a bit against Medvedev as well. Is it Ferrero? Is that what's going on here?
Good question.
You mean him being back in his box and around him all the time? Yeah, because obviously he was absent at the Australian Open. I think possibly. I think Juan Carlos Ferrero being there is just so important for Carlos Alcaraz generally. I think he just feels a lot more comfortable. And Ferrero is constantly talking to him on the side and giving him advice, and I'm sure is helping him prepare even better for these matches as well. I do slightly wonder whether, you know, taking some losses just humbles you a little bit. Not that he needed to be, you know, he's but I feel like for so long Alcaraz could just play his game and soar and that would kind of work. But I don't know, I think some of the losses he's taken since Wimbledon has maybe got him or the team thinking, okay, like we know his peak level is probably the best, but he's not always going to have it, and he needs to come up with sort of mid-match solutions a bit more. And he was much tactically smarter against Zverev this time around in Indian Wells, playing the forehand a lot more, and much tactically smarter, as you said, against Sinner as well. So I think a combination of sort of perhaps needing it a little bit, perhaps needing to rely on a few more tactics rather than just peak level all the time. And yeah, Ferrero in his corner. I mean, so pleased that Juan Carlos Ferrero hugs are back in our life.
Yes, I mean they do a really good job in Indian Wells, I think, of miking up the coaching boxes, and those, the sort of the audio stream from both is just kind of there as part of the audio experience of watching. And Juan Carlos Ferrero talks a lot and seems to be saying very specific things as well. But the Alcaraz Ferrero hugs are back. I have missed them so. I don't think that effect is ever going to wear off. It really got me, the Alcaraz Ferrero hug. We've been without them for so long, and a lot of people really focusing on this first title since Wimbledon element for Alcaraz, aren't they? And suddenly there's a narrative of how stupid everybody was to ever doubt him or to ever worry about him or to ever question the fact that he hadn't won a title since Wimbledon. Well, it's all very well saying that now, but the fact is he did go a long time without winning a title, and that wasn't an accident. And for a man of his clear capabilities and powers, there was something going on there, and he doesn't deny there was something going on there. I think his English is very noticeably improving all the time. It's incredible, really, the strides he's making. But he's still obviously not able to express himself as he is in his native language. But in a Tennis Channel interview I saw, he was kind of describing, I didn't feel bad on the court, but it just wasn't quite right. It just hasn't been quite right. And he said he was worried about the ankle. He didn't even know if he was going to play in Indian Wells. It sounds like his head was quite cloudy for a long time. And suddenly, you know, the this is the Indian Wells effect, isn't it? The clarity of that mountain air, you can just see it all lifted. But for Carlos Alcaraz and his talent and ability and the trajectory he was on, David, it was a long time without a title.
Yeah, a really long time, I think. Given the way he went to Cincinnati, went rampaging through the draw there and looked like he was going to beat Djokovic, and then that turned around and he's not really been the same since that match turned around. And it did make me think when he announced that he was doing his own Netflix documentary. And I got the sense that maybe he's about to tell us something in that that's gone on or that's worried him or that's bothered him in his life. Because he kind of has alluded to it a little bit, that he's not been really himself, not been very happy by comparison to how he normally feels. And obviously, when you're not winning tennis matches, that will be a factor in your life. Maybe that's it. Maybe he's felt the pressure internally of, you know, I've got to do it. I've got to put on a show. I mean, this is a guy cramped in that match against Djokovic at the French Open. He's a guy who feels things, isn't he? He's not impervious. And I am interested to see, but I mean, right from the first sort of spell of sets that he won in a row, those first four sets that he won in this tournament, we all felt this is the guy that we all fell for, you know. And there's that security to go with the occasional pizzazz, you know. It's just it just feels as though it's there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, he said afterwards that he was actually sort of less worried about the results that he'd been having since Wimbledon and more just that feeling of on court. And he said that kind of like his team had told him, you're not smiling so much. You don't look as sort of joyous and happy. And he felt that on the court. And I think that was perhaps, you know, whether that was leading to the poorer results or the poorer results were leading to that feeling of not being quite so happy, it's kind of tough to say. But he totally had that back. That Alcarazmataz was back, wasn't it? And I think in a way it will be helpful to have gone through a period like this. I think, you know, it's kind of what separates the greats from everyone else, isn't it? Like, you can't be at your absolute best all the time. Even the big three, even Serena have had moments in their careers where they've not been at their best. But being able to turn it round and not letting it turn into a full-on slump, that's what sort of separates the greats from others, I think, as well. And I think the players he beat this tournament's really significant as well. Like, it felt like a bit of a revenge tour. You know, we spoke at the start of the week about Auger-Aliassime and Marijan had had wins over him in the past. And then his final three wins to win the tournament were against Alexander Zverev, who beat him at the Australian Open, Jannik Sinner, who has become the sort of dominant player in the last 6 months since, you know, while Alcaraz hasn't been having his best results, and then Medvedev, who beat him at the US Open as well. And they were 4-1 and 2 in the race coming into this year. You know, they were some of the most informed players in the world, and Alcaraz beat them all consecutively just to sort of remind everyone that his peak level is right there with them and maybe even above. And yeah, so I think it's a really significant week in terms of Alcaraz finding his joy again, and also, you know, sort of correcting some of those matchups.
In his post-win press conference, some sort of traumatic event alarm went off. There's a clip of it doing the rounds that I'm sure lots of you have seen. And there's a Alcaraz is sort of like, do I stay? Do I go? There's sort of a honk, 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 go to your nearest fire exit. But obviously, no one's moving. It doesn't sound like the journalists are going anywhere. So he's a bit like, oh, what do we do, guys? Mm-hmm. And then he just gently goes. And this comment did not get the reaction it deserved. Maybe the mics didn't pick up the reaction. I hope that was the case. But he goes, maybe it's the fire I left on the court. And it was absolute perfection. And then he goes, first the bees, now this. What a dramatic event Carlos Alcaraz ended up having. Interesting that this was the same final that we had last year. Same straight sets result. Okay, a far more competitive first set than we had in either set last year. But it did feel like a very, very different match to me. I remember I was there for, well, we were all there, weren't we, for the final last year. And I remember thinking, oh, well, Medvedev's never going to beat Alcaraz. Like, this is as clear a matchup problem as there will ever be in tennis, unless Medvedev can develop just a completely new way of playing tennis, or Alcaraz's form drops off a cliff if he, you know, loses four toes on one foot or something. Like, he's just never going to beat him. I didn't feel that way yesterday. I didn't feel like this is a fundamental matchup problem for Daniil Medvedev, in particular because he has that enormous lever that he's able to pull with altering his return position. I think that's one of the biggest sort of tactical, technical levers that any player has at their disposal in the sport. Usually it's tinkering at the edges, isn't it? But Medvedev was standing sort of on average 3 metres further in to return the Alcaraz serve to what he was last year. It didn't feel like a tactical, it didn't feel like a fundamental matchup issue to me yesterday. It just felt like when Alcaraz is playing well, he's a better tennis player, and Medvedev needs to be absolutely at his peak to have a chance, like he was in the US Open semi-final, and he just wasn't close enough to his peak yesterday. Mm.
Yeah, I think that's a good point, you know, and I think it illustrates how Medvedev thinks. He isn't prepared to just be your matchup problem guy. He is going to do something to change things, and good for him, because he needed to. Because had he stayed at the back and just allowed Alcaraz to just drop shot him into oblivion or serve and volley him off the court with angles, well, then yes, it is a matchup problem and it's never going to change unless Alcaraz has the worst day of his life. But there is a way around it. And that's what I've loved about this week. I've liked that about Medvedev all year, actually, that he has decided to change that. And as mentioned about Alcaraz doing it in the last couple of matches back to his opponents, tactics are such an underrated element to the sport in terms of enjoyment for me. I mean, I love the pizzazz of the ground stroke battles and all the rest of it, but just seeing somebody prepared to do something different and it occasionally paying off, I'm all for that. But I do think Medvedev, just generally, it's a real test of his, How much patience he's got with all this, you know? How many times can you keep on getting to the bloody final and not winning these big matches against these big players? It must do his head in, and he keeps coming back for more. So, and I'm glad he does.
Yeah, he's kind of in a bit of an Andy Murray 10, 12 years ago situation. Like, there's a kind of big four forming on the ATP Tour. If you go back through the major events since Wimbledon last year, Djokovic, Sinner, Alcaraz, Medvedev, you know, kind of at least three of them have been pretty much in the semifinals of kind of all the big events since then. There's this pack element, and Medvedev is right there among them, but he's lost five of his last six against Djokovic. He's lost four in a row against Sinner, and he's lost four of his last five against Alcaraz, and he's lost his last five finals, all of them against Djokovic, Sinner, or Alcaraz. He's getting so close, but he's coming up short against all of them. And I did think there was a slightly deflated feeling to him right at the end of that match. You know, he was sort of game-wise, I think he knew that he didn't have it compared to Alcaraz yesterday. And I think kind of the fans were getting to him a little bit, weren't they? With Alcaraz was getting all the love as well. And he was sort of mimicking that and saying, go on, keep supporting Carlos Alcaraz, keep supporting him right at the end. And look, I know that's kind of his thing, but I do think he seemed a little bit deflated yesterday. It was like a moment of realization that this just keeps happening to him. And, you know, I'll go back to what I said before, like, he really needs to sort his serve out. I did a bit of a deep dive on the top 10 on the ATP Tour today. he's the only one in the top 10 who is not holding serve 80% of the time this year. Like that's a sort of barrier that everyone in the top 10 is hitting. He's just under, but he is under. And, you know, that shows that, like, Rude is getting more out of it. Runa, who aren't, and Alex de Minaur, I know he's improved his serve a lot, but you wouldn't say his serve is what Medvedev's used to be. Like, there's so much potential, I think, for Medvedev to be even better than he is now if he can find that serve again. But it's been such a long time that it hasn't been the weapon that it used to be. It's like, he's so consistent, but he hasn't won a title since Rome. Like, maybe the good news is that the clay court season's coming and he can win a title again. Who would have said that?
He's got blooming points to defend this time around on clay, though. That's not what he wants, is it? And he's, of course, got points to defend in Miami, won the title there last year. I do think his serve dropping off a cliff has made the rest of his game better. Okay, not yesterday, I think. The relentless pressure from Alcaraz was too much, but the precision of his ground game, I mean, the guy just does not miss. The precision and the patience is incredible, and he's having to rely on that so
they
much
shouldn't
more,
be related though, should they? Like, he should be able to have both at the same time.
Yeah, I agree. I feel for him so much. He doesn't deserve to be in the bridesmaid role, just as Andy Murray didn't for so many years. Like, you're too good to be the also-ran, but also, like, you know, the results don't lie, do they? There are just other better people, and it's a tough sport. Kulhoff and Mektic won the doubles title. They beat Marcel Granollers and Horacio Zaballos 7-6, 7-6. In the final. A couple of bits of other results from last week. Matteo Berrettini is reaching the final of a challenger back. Matt, that wrote the agenda, thinks it is.
He's back on tour.
He's physically back. Yeah. He lost to Nuno Borges in the final. Whilst doing some Lucanardi-based Googling last week, I discovered that Matteo Berrettini is currently the Italian number 8. It was a tough scene, anyway, for Matteo. So we wish you back. We wish you well.
He had a couple of decent wins. He beat Artur Kazul, who had such a good start to the season. He beat Vukic, who got a set off Djokovic at Indian Wells. He beat just a series of Frenchmen. He beat Terence Atman, who's a very amusing player, and Hugo Gaston, also an amusing player. And he's in the draw
in
Miami.
Matt is amused by Frenchmen. That's what we've learnt there. The ITF announced this week what the host cities will be for the 2024 Davis Cup Finals group stage, the draw of which is taking place tomorrow. So the host cities are Bologna, Manchester, Valencia and Zhuhai in China. I think most of those would have been expected. Zhuhai, the slight surprise in there, although there have been calls for it to be less Europe-centric and more global. So that's, you know, that's three European locations and one.
But China not even playing, which is an interesting situation. And will test once again the ability to create an atmosphere.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm pretty anxious about that test.
So am I.
Time will tell. We'll see. We're going to have a little look at the Miami draws. I think the main draw gets underway tomorrow.
For the women.
Wednesday?
Women Tuesday.
The women get underway.
Men Wednesday. Because it's
two-week events.
Yeah. And then the finals are on different days in Miami. It's not an Indian Wells situation with both finals on the same day.
Which do you prefer out of those two? Do you prefer?
I like the Indian Wells finals on the same day. Yeah, I really like that. I wish they'd mix it up with the order, all of that. But yeah, so we're going to talk about. We've got a few minutes just to talk about the Miami draws. But before that, while I have your attention, first of all, if you're with us on YouTube, please do like and subscribe to our page. It helps. It costs you nothing, and it helps us immensely. don't quite know why, but I do know that that is something that YouTubers always say. And we are YouTubers now, folks. So I have to do that point of order. So please give us a like and a subscribe. Also, if you like what you do and would like to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast, you won't regret it, folks. We have some really excellent friends content coming your way. In the near and extremely near future, we have a live show coming up on Wednesday. That's going to be a Q&A show. That's 8 p.m. UK time, so exactly the same timings as tonight's live show. We have our next Tennis Relived episode that we're going to be recording very soon indeed. And we've got a big interview for it that David and I are going to do. Can I say the location, David, as a teaser?
Yeah.
David and I are going to Wimbledon to do an interview on Thursday. And pumped. We have our community platform launching with Hannah, who many of you are enjoying the company of in the chat right now. Well, if you'd like to do more of that, we're going to be launching our community space after... Well, no, I was going to say after Indian Wells. That's what we've been saying, but it is now after Indian Wells. We're launching it next week, aren't we? And it's going to be... brilliant. We're very excited about it. That's exclusively for friends of the Tennis Podcast. If you'd like to become a friend of the Tennis Podcast, the link to do that is in our show notes. Now, Miami. We have Świątek aiming to complete the Sunshine Double. It would be her second time doing that. She, of course, did it as part of Le Streak in 2022. Coco Gauff has fallen into her half. We have Elena Rybakina and Aryna Sabalenka in the other half. Good God, I just want Elena Rybakina to be fit and healthy for this goddamn tournament. That feels like a big, big wish list item for Miami, for me. Rybakina being Rybakina again.
Yeah, and I'd love to see Rybakina and then... Sabalenka find her form again, you know, and the big three, the big four, be there playing like that again. You know, it's a big ask, of course, because I mean it's a deep field, but I mean, and particularly as you say, Rybakina without the fitness is the main issue. But yeah, I hope that this is a bit of a reboot and that they're all there, fit and firing.
And the biggest story in the women's tournament, certainly for the opening few days, is the return of Simona Halep. She's been drawn to face Paula Badosa in round one. Who knows if Badosa is fit? I mean, she pulled out of Indian Wells, didn't she, with the same back injury that's been troubling her for months and months now. It seems unlikely to me that that would suddenly be healed within the space of less than 2 weeks, but who knows? Goodness me. That's giving me... Sharapova returning in Stuttgart vibes when I remember so many members of the media travelled to this. It's not a small event in Stuttgart, it's a great event, but relatively small given the media presence and attention they had that week. And I suspect Halep in Miami this week is going to have a similar vibe about it. I'm not gonna throw you under the bus and say what are we expecting, because how on earth, David, are we supposed to have any idea what to expect from Simona Halep? Well, I mean that's impossible to know.
She certainly throughout the period of absence talked about staying in shape, but I think she also got to a point where it was dragging on for so long, and then the verdict came in and it was such a long sentence that must be become very difficult to maintain that level of intensity and professionalism to stay in shape. But the gist that she's been giving off is that she's going to be ready whenever the moment comes. And also she's a very naturally fit player, isn't she? Like she's just a really great athlete. What a mover she is. It's a long time out. So you can't expect too much. But she's a heck of a player, and she's not too old. And I think she'll give a good account of herself if she can just be physically okay.
I mean, I think that's a good draw because I just don't think Paola Badosa is is fit, but she would play Sabalenka if she beats Badosa. Other round one matches include Vekic against Pliskova, Kerber against Stevens. Yes, please. And Naomi Osaka has drawn Elisabetta Cocciaretto, which is a name that I enjoy saying.
Who is coming off a title. Cocciaretto won a sort of lower level event and has won a lot of matches recently. That's perhaps harder than it looks for Osaka.
She could do with building on... It was decent for her, Indian Wells, Osaka, but she could do with building on that and having another at least decent event, I think, in Miami. Alcaraz aiming to win his second Miami title. Of course, it was his debut Masters 1000 event, wasn't it, a couple of years ago. He's in the same half as Alexander Zverev. Sinner and Medvedev are in the other half. Kei Nishikori's in the draw, guys. Actual Kei Nishikori.
Goodness.
I've been on alert.
When was the last time either of you thought about Kei Nishikori? Matt's going to say, like, oh, I think about him all the time.
He's got a stat.
Great backhand. No, I've been on alert for Kei Nishikori news because do you remember that moment during the Australian Open where Novak Djokovic's press conference was sort of taken over by a journalist asking questions about Kei Nishikori? And I was like...
Yes, there was a Nishikori-based filibuster.
Yeah. I was like, surely this means that some Kei Nishikori news is about to drop and we need some, you know, journalists need some quotes from Novak Djokovic. But no, I've been waiting for 6 weeks, but here we are. And he is in the draw as a wild card.
Wow.
Unexpected.
Unexpected. Andy Murray is also in the draw. He's facing Matteo Berrettini in a sad off. no, that's harsh. I mean, I'll be watching that and I'll be loving it. But, you know, there's been a lot of injury trauma there. Artur Fils has got Matteo Arnaldi in the first round. Sonego's got Dan Evans. That's tough for him, isn't it? And we have Darwin Blanche with a main draw wild card. Darwin Blanche is a very young junior player. What would he be, 16 now? 16, that we were tipped off about during the French Open last year by Mary Carrillo. I think Lindsay Davenport was pretty into his talent. He's certainly somebody that America is very excited about, and Matt went out to watch him play, I think, at the French Open last year. But he is incredibly young. I guess he's an IMG player and that's why he's got that wild card. They do tend to do that there, but I just worry that that is premature.
And he's drawn but we'll all be the watching. Best player in the world.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Not the literal best player in the world though, right?
No, the tennis spiritual. Podcast coded best player in the world.
I'd say that's going to be tough for a 16-year-old.
Yeah, he's kind of been Carlos Alcaraz's hitting partner for the last year as well. He trains at the Ferrero Academy, so he's used to hitting with Alcaraz. But yeah, like this is a huge step up. He's not played anything close to this level, so it'll be quite interesting.
He's not even played challenges, has he? I think he's played juniors and ITFs.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. That worries me a bit.
Wishing him luck.
Wishing him luck. I've just been alerted to the fact that Luca Nardi against Jakub Mensik is just starting in qualifying. That's very tennis podcast coded as well, isn't it?
Yeah, your brother's switched us off and put that on.
Definitely.
Double screening, Matt.
we'll be doing the same very shortly, but not before we tell you about Mel. We told you about Mel before. I recognise Mel. Mel is a second-year returning mascot. Loves the podcast as it usually means time outside. Mel is a 7-year-old Havanese. Very Billie Jean energy, I would say, about Mel. But I think maybe slightly short. Billie Jean's got sort of a very small body but long legs. And Mel's legs look a little bit shorter. Lovely dogs, Havanese. He enjoys keeping up with his cousins on long walks. A reminder that she told us last year that Patricia, Mel's owner, got Mel as a puppy as a bribe to keep their daughter close for college. She promptly moved to LA and left a very spoiled lapdog for us. She says, update, daughter came back briefly from college, but then, of course, moved out again, this time to Dublin for med school, and they've been left with a very needy Havanese. What could be better, Patricia, than a needy Havanese, is what I say. Mel is absolutely gorgeous, and I'll be putting his picture on our Instagram. We have our mascots. I got some points for Darwin's memory this week. Oh, yeah, finally, Carlos Alcaraz. What a banker. David had Francis. You got some Świątek points, I believe, David.
And the second Matt time of asking.
With Haida and Soma, any points for you, Matt?
No.
Hey!
Okay.
Oops, sorry.
Billie Jean she's in the vicinity, folks, but she didn't want to be on. She got a bit bashful for some reason, didn't want to be on camera anymore. She's pooped to my side. But she is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our top folks and executive producers, Chris, Greg, Jamie and Jeff. And Matt, we have shout-outs. And everyone joining on YouTube gets to see our face while we're trying to think of names to go with the shout-outs. Take it away, Matt.
We start with Brian Ahrens in Stratford, Ontario, Canada.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Stratford-upon-Avon, but no.
Or Stratford, the Stratford that the Eurostar stops at.
Hmm.
Take your pick.
Talking of which, Catherine, I remember many, many years ago when I had some comedy tickets for a performance in Stratford, and I got the wrong Stratford, and so I thought there was Stratford upon Avon, so I gave them to you. I seem to recall because it was Stratford, London.
Oh yes,
it's only about 15 years ago. Anyway,
I'd totally forgotten about that. Wow. Brian's, you've got your teacher, you've got Freed.
This is good.
You've got your Brian brothers, you've got your Shelton. I've got some
Brian Baker
in the chat here.
Remember him?
Baker. Yes. Oh, are we talking Brian with a Y or Brian with an I?
It's Brian with an I, so Brian Shelton is out.
I haven't got the chat.
And
up,
the Brian
so I'm
brothers
just,
around.
I'm thinking you're a genius, Catherine. I'm so impressed. And turns out it's the listeners who are geniuses.
Thank you very much, Brian, in Stratford.
We've also got Sam Royston in Coventry.
All right, Sam. Coventry up the
Hello,
road.
Hello, Sam. Coventry had a... He had a good... Is Sam a Coventry fan? Great weekend for them in the football.
Yeah, Magic of the Cup.
Couldn't beat Albion, though, could you?
The Cup. Sam
Stozer.
Sam's
Query,
Stozer,
who was in Indian Wells in a box watching
our mate Dave of having a terrible time at the French Open fame, has been texting us about Sam Query today, saying apparently he's doing some really fun social media output.
I have actually seen a video that was quite funny from Sam Query. Yeah.
Where did he hide that for 15 years?
He did do one about 15 years ago, and he was quite good on Twitter for about 3 months, and then he just deleted his account. Don't know why.
Okay. I'll give him a follow.
It was content related to the fact that sort of some of the extras at the Netflix Slam were that you could have like a private... could have like a private lesson or coaching session with Nadal, and it was like $150,000 or something. And you could also have one with Sam Query and John Isner, and it was like $2,000. and he was pointing out that there was, you know, there'd be lots that he could do for you for $2,000.
Yeah. No, I think what he was saying he would do for 150.
Yeah, for 150, he would do all these things.
And it wasn't just play a tennis match.
I don't think I'd want him to do any of the things offering.
Check out the video, Catherine.
Rate how much you'd pay.
Okay, is he a pickleball guy?
Oh yeah,
sadly yes. Yeah, you can't have everything, can you?
Did you see, David, that Katy Perry is a pickleball person? She did a video.
Who's that?
Katy Perry.
You know Katy Perry.
I kissed a girl and I liked it. It's getting clipped up, isn't it? Next shout out. Thank you very much, Sam.
Next shout out is for Jane Alexander Bullman, who is from Voorhees, New Jersey.
Wow. New Jersey represented again. Wow.
James, like James Blake, the tournament director of Miami Open.
No, I think Jane.
Jane, David.
Oh, sorry, Jane.
Like Jane O'Donoghue.
Yes.
Coach, former coach of Emma Raducanu.
Jane Herdlicker.
the Australian Open. Woman.
What a shame. Yeah.
We better get off here.
Well, wasn't I think Peaches Barkowitz is a Jane. Jane Peaches Barkowitz, I believe.
Okay, that is excellent. Thank you, Jane. Is that it, or we got more?
I'm out.
I think people probably want it to be it. Thank you, Jane. Thank you, Sam. Thank you, Brian. Thank you to all friends of the Tennis Podcast that keep this show on the road. Thank you to everybody listening. Thank you to everybody that joined us live tonight. It's been extremely fun. And we love that so many of you enjoy this and want to join us live. And we're going to be doing our weekly Monday shows as live YouTube shows after every combined 1,000 event. So that means we'll be doing another one in a couple of weeks' time after Miami. But we'll be back with a regular weekly show on Monday. We'll also be back Thursday next week. And then we'll have a live show a week on Monday as well. But if you can't wait till then, become a friend of the pod and join our live Q&A show on Wednesday. Thanks for listening. We will speak to you very soon.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.